BCFM, community radio for Bristol on 93.2 FM. For more information or to listen live on the internet, go to our website at www.bcfm.org.uk. BCFM, your radio. Wake up to yesterday on BCFM. Midnight to midday, we repeat all the programmes so you can catch up on all the ones you've missed or just enjoy them again. BCFM 93.2 FM. Your choice, your voice.
Hello and welcome to this week's Dalek Radio. Welcome to you from Queen Square Studio in Bristol. We're part of the Bristol Radio Co-op. Hello to everyone in Bristol and everyone in Preston, and to all of those accessing the show across the world by the internet. Our studio guests this week are Bristol Conservative MEP Ashley Fox and Joseph Lavery, who's going to talk about the British activists who worked on the Obama campaign and what effect this might have on the future political scene in Britain. Tony Goslin brings us part four of his feature on 21st century espionage. Anthony Page reports on the Trowbridge Village Pump Festival in Wiltshire, and Malcolm Greaves reads another instalment of The Innkeeper's Diary by John Fothergill, set in Oxfordshire in the 1920s. Jess Sparks, as ever, is here to bring us what's going on in Bristol this week, and I'm John Peters Coleman, presenter of this week's show. Before I start the first interview, I'm going to read you a press cutting, seeing as it's festival season, from the Bristol Indymedia website about the cancellation of the Big Green Gathering Festival this week. And the headline, breaking news, the Big Green Gathering has been shut down by police. The Big Green Gathering, a fixture in the alternative calendar, was due to return after 2 years this week. 15,000 to 20,000 people were expected to turn up on Wednesday the 29th to the site near Cheddar, Somerset, for Europe's largest green event, a five-day festival promoting sustainability and renewable energy, with everything from allotments to alternative media. Hundreds of staff and volunteers were already on site, and its cancellation comes just days before the gates were due to open. Organisers, most of whom work for nothing, are absolutely gutted. One told Schnooze, "We are so disappointed not to be having this year's gathering. It means so much to so many people." A last-minute injunction by Mendip District Council, supported by Avon and Somerset Police, put the kibosh on the entire event, citing the potential for crime and disorder and safety concerns. This was despite the fact that the festival had actually been granted a licence on the 30th of June. According to Avon and Somerset Police's website, quote, "We went above and beyond the call of duty to ensure this event took place." The injunction was due to be heard in the High Court in London on Monday the 27th. However, before that could happen, the Big Green Gathering organisers surrendered the festival licence on Sunday morning. As soon as this was done, a police commander at the meeting was overheard saying into his radio, "Operation Fortress is go." Police have already set up roadblocks and promised to turn festival goers back. Chief Inspector Paul Richards, festival liaison, later confirmed to one of the festival organisers that, quote, "this is political," adding that the decision had been made over his head at county level. One of Schnooze's sources on site said the police were frank about the fact that the closure had been planned for 2 weeks. Quote, "This was a blatant act of political sabotage. The Big Green Gathering is now completely bankrupt. They knew that we were going to be closed down, and yet they carried on allowing us to spend money hand over fist on infrastructure." We're not just banging on about festivals being free because we miss the good old days. There's a huge difference between being a punter who has a whole experience laid on for them, i.e. glass those themed areas with helpful stewards pointing you in the direction of the consumer delights, and being part of a festival or free party where everyone's responsible for the entertainment and even infrastructure like welfare. A crowd that feels its own event behaves differently to one that feels it has paid to have an experience. The fact that undercover police now feel free to operate and arrest people without any backup for cannabis use or nudity, see Schnooze 684 and 603 at festivals, has a lot to do with the sheep-like behaviour of punters, a mentality that our masters are keen to see enforced. And I'm sure we'll have further news on that in the coming days and weeks. I'd like to welcome to the studio now Ashley Fox. Hello.
Hello, John.
Well, congratulations on recently becoming a member of the European Parliament.
Thank you very much.
So how long have you been an MEP now?
I became an MEP on the 14th of July, which, if you know your French history, le 14 juillet is the day they stormed the Bastille. And that's how it feels like being a Conservative in the European Parliament.
Wow, okay. So what political experience do you have as a minister of or a member of anything previous
to... I haven't been a minister at all, I promise you, but I am still a councillor on Bristol City Council. I represent the ward of Westbury-on-Trym,
right.
And I've done that for the last 7 years and enjoy it very much.
OK. So what other interaction with other political parties that are also serving in the Brussels Parliament, other British parties have you had?
Well, I sit on the Economic and Monetary Affairs Committee. I've introduced myself to Sharon Bowles, who is the chairman. She's a Liberal Democrat. And also Peter Skinner, who's the Labour spokesman on that committee. So apart from that, I haven't met any other MEPs from other parties.
OK. Is there a little bit of what I imagine is sort of an orientation or an induction ceremony when you first turn up to Brussels? What did it feel like the first time you turned up?
Well, actually what happened was at the first session was in Strasbourg, and I know you're going to talk about why do we have two parliaments, but yep. We went to Strasbourg first of all, but in fact we'd been invited to Brussels the week before for just that induction meeting,
right.
Where we signed our names and gave details and we were given a temporary pass and did all the formalities that meant when we arrived on the 14th of July, we were fully fledged MEPs and we could just get on with the job.
OK, was there a bit of... I don't know, a bit of Bucks Fizz with champagne and a bit of a hurrah because you're fresh in? Or
not in Strasbourg, no. I mean, we had this... You'll remember that the elections were on the 7th of June.
Yeah.
So there was nearly a six-week gap between being elected and taking my seat.
Okay.
So, you know, the celebrations had followed the 7th of June and I'm afraid the champagne had been cleared away a long time before.
Okay. What is the Conservative Party's position? How successful are they in the Brussels Parliament? What is their sort of standing at the moment? Are there a lot of you?
Yes, there are. We are the biggest single British group. There are 72 British MEPs and 26 of those are British Conservatives.
Right.
So we're twice the size of the Labour group, who have 13, twice the size of the UKIP group, who also have 13.
Okay.
So... we are, you know, we won those elections. We are the largest single group. And having gone to Europe, we have formed a new grouping with like-minded centre-right parties. The important difference is that we are anti-federalist. We do not wish to see any further political union. So whilst we can cooperate with the other centre-right parties on economic matters, on trade matters, what we're not going to cooperate on is further political integration at a European level, because we do not wish to see any more power transferred from this country to Brussels.
That's quite important, really, because the Conservative Party is famous for having a big split on Europe, with half being very pro, like Ken Clark, for example, and the other half being very against. I mean, how do you feel the Conservative Party is going to continue? Because they don't really seem to have given...
I mean, I don't accept that there is a big split anymore.
Right.
I would accept if you go back 15 years to when John Major was Prime Minister, yes, the party was split. And that was the reason that we lost, one of the reasons why we lost the 97 election.
Yeah.
Because the electorate will not vote for a divided party. That's one reason, incidentally, why Gordon Brown won't win the next election. But coming back to us, I think 99% of the party is united around David Cameron's position. Very supportive of this new European Conservative and Reformist group, which we've successfully set up with parties from seven other countries. We are moderate, we're centre-right, but we are anti-federalist.
OK, have you really got time for two jobs? Because you're still a local councillor and yet you're also an MEP. How do you split your time?
I spend about three nights a week in Strasbourg or Brussels, depending on where we're sitting. But there are two councillors for every ward in Westbury-on-Trym, and my good colleague Jeff Gollop helps me out. But in fact, most of a councillor's work nowadays, helping his constituents, is done by email. So I can deal with those inquiries whether I'm sitting at my desk in Brussels or at home. So it's not really causing any difficulty at all.
OK. I noticed earlier on you said you remember you were on an economics committee and it immediately sprung to mind. I mean, why haven't the EU budgets been passed for many years now?
You're referring to the accounts.
Yeah.
The accounts have not been signed off.
Does that not look dubious?
It looks very dubious indeed. It's absolutely disgraceful. They haven't been signed off for 14 years. And when those accounts are not signed off by the Court of Auditors... because they're not satisfied that the commission, which spends the money, can account for how it says it has spent that money. And when those accounts have not been discharged, they come before the European Parliament, and the Parliament then has to decide what to do about it. Now, the British Conservatives have voted to reject those unaudited accounts.
Right.
And the result of doing that would be that the Commission would be sacked. But I'm afraid that year after year, those accounts are not audited. They come to the Parliament, and the Parliament votes to approve them anyway. And you'll be able to ask members of the Labour Party, members of the Liberal Democrats, why they consistently vote to approve those accounts that the auditors have rejected.
It makes Brussels look like a big gravy train, really, wouldn't you not say?
Yes, it does. It looks very poor indeed. And that is something that British Conservatives are determined to improve, the financial bookkeeping of the Commission, of the European Union, and also to ensure that we get value for taxpayers' money, because the EU has a reputation for wasting money, and we want to stop that.
Now, you mentioned this grouping with other parties from other countries. I mean, a lot of people have been quite concerned that you've moved grouping. You used to be in a more centre political alignment with other groups, and you've moved further right. You've moved to what looks like an extreme right grouping.
I reject that entirely. We were a member of the EPP,
yeah,
a centre-right group, and we are now a member of another centre-right group. I don't think that we have moved to the right, as you characterise it, at all. The difference between our grouping and the EPP is our view on political union.
Right.
And that actually isn't a left or right point of view.
You're anti-federalist.
We're anti-federalist. Yeah. The Green Party, who I don't think you'd describe as being a right-wing party,
no,
want to see powers repatriated to Britain.
Okay.
Tony Benn, that well-known right-winger, as perhaps you'd characterise him, doesn't want to see any further power going to Brussels.
Okay.
So this issue of whether you are a federalist, as the Liberal Democrats certainly are,
yeah,
or the Conservatives, and we're not, that is not a left-right issue. And I think it's wrong for the media to characterise that movement as a move to the right.
OK, should we ratify the Lisbon Treaty?
No.
Why not?
We shouldn't ratify it, first of all, because the British people have not been consulted. Now, if there were a referendum, I would urge my fellow citizens to vote no. And I do so because I don't want to see any more power transferred to Brussels. But that said, if the British people voted yes, I'm a Democrat, I'd accept that. And what you have to remember is that at the last election, all three parties said they would have a referendum on the Constitution.
Yeah.
That was rejected. The Lisbon Treaty emerges. It's 99% the same. The only thing that was dropped was the anthem and the flag and the name of the foreign minister. Nothing of substance was changed. And yet Gordon Brown used that as an excuse to wheedle out of a referendum. And the reason he did that was he thought he'd lose.
How do you feel about the ex-leader of the Labour Party, Blair, supposedly being a favoured candidate for the President of Europe, a role which doesn't technically exist yet?
No. I mean, I don't want to see a President of Europe at all. And I think that Tony Blair would be a perfectly ghastly choice.
Right. I wanted to touch, kind of lastly, on the reportage and coverage of the Brussels Parliament. It's not really considered very important, partly because we don't really see anything about it in the papers. I mean, what is your favourite paper or organisation, if you like, in terms of reportage? Who do you deem to have credibility in terms of how they cover what goes on in Brussels? Because you don't really see
very few newspapers cover what goes on in the European Parliament. And the reason for that is because much of what we do is very detailed. The Commission will propose a piece of legislation. Then the Council of Ministers will consider it. And then that detailed piece of legislation comes to the Parliament to examine it line by line. So we really are changing dots and commas and moving words about. Now that has a profound effect on how people live their lives. You know, the Working Time Directive would affect, for example, how many hours our doctors can work, whether we could have retained firemen working in country areas. So it's very important. But the actual work we do is particularly detailed, and it doesn't lend itself to detailed coverage, which is why, unfortunately, you get stories about banning bent bananas and things, because that's an easy story to sell even if it isn't a terribly accurate one.
Right, so what should we do if we want to find out more about what goes on? Where do we turn?
Well, I'm not convinced that you can force people to be interested in politics. The EU at the moment is thinking of spending something like 17 million euros extra on an information campaign to tell us how worthy they are. Now, I think that's a waste of money, because I think people are either interested in politics or they're not. And they're not going to be suddenly more interested by having adverts appear on the internet, in newspapers, and so on. So, and I think, you know, if someone is interested, they'll probably find that information for themselves.
Yep.
There's masses of information on the internet, but I don't think that this is a subject that is going to appear in mainstream newspapers, because most people aren't interested in it. And what newspapers are interested in doing is selling copy.
Okay.
I'm afraid Europolitics doesn't sell copy.
It doesn't, no. Okay, well, thank you very much, Ashley Fox, and it would be nice to catch up with you in future months to see how you're getting on.
That's a pleasure, thanks.
Thank you.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
Our next guest is Joseph Lavery, who's currently studying at the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia. You're studying comparative literature.
That's right, yes.
Sounded like I was doing Mastermind then, and your questions start now. So, you worked on the Obama campaign.
I did. I did some phone banking for the Obama campaign, and I did some leafleting, and I went to a few rallies and things like that. I wasn't by any means one of the main organisers in Philadelphia, but one of the things that I've tried to do since the campaign is to keep in touch with the campaigning wing of the administration, and then also to get involved in other kinds of activist campaigns, like particularly MoveOn.org. And this is something that's really grown up around the Obama campaign, actually. There's been a huge growth in activism.
Okay, I mean, just on the technicalities, I mean, you're British, I guess. You have
yes,
British
that's
possible,
right. Yes.
But you are allowed to a certain extent to kind of work on an American political...
Oh, certainly, and I certainly wasn't alone. There were a great number of British people who came over to America to work on the campaign. I think people recognise that the presidency of the United States is a role that affects people worldwide.
Mm.
And I think Americans in particular want to hear from people who come from outside the United States. And particularly after 8 years of an administration that was so insular and really didn't seem to care two hoots about what the rest of the world thought,
yeah.
It's quite inspiring and interesting to speak to Americans who really do want to know what they can do to involve themselves in the world community
okay.
more productively.
So apart from the fact that, well, I guess Obama is obviously better than Bush as far as most people are concerned, what really did you, what inspired you about Obama that made you travel to the US?
Well,
did you travel there to campaign?
It's easy to say what it wasn't. And I think one thing it certainly wasn't was anything approaching policy. The guy is basically a neoliberal and sort of, in economic terms, seems to follow the Clintonite agenda. What I think is unique and fascinating and exciting about the Obama campaign and, by extension, the Obama administration is the way in which he's really, for the first time in American politics, built a totally grassroots organization, such that the average donation to the campaign was $60.
Right.
There was comparatively little funding by huge protest groups or huge pressure groups. He's really done very well. Partly, it has to be said, acting under legislation which was brought in by John McCain and Russ Feingold. But he's worked very well to make sure that he has a very, very large and very low donating organisation. And one of the things this means is that there's something really approaching a structure of accountability for government.
Right.
Because people who voted for him the first time round will want to make sure that their interests are represented in government and that that's going to be something...
Okay.
Important for the next election.
So obvious next question. I mean, how do you feel that Obama is actually doing? I mean, he's been in his administration has been running for well over 100 days now.
Over six months.
Are people's hopes being fulfilled?
Well, it's a difficult question. And I think that at the moment his approval ratings are beginning to take a tumble. He's down to 54% now. And that comes after what has probably been the most difficult 2 weeks of his presidency so far. He's had a great deal of difficulty persuading Congress to enact healthcare legislation before the end of the summer. And he's also got into a little bit of trouble by making slightly hedged remarks, slightly hesitant and reticent remarks about the Henry Louis Gates affair.
Mm.
By and large, I think that there's been certain kinds of progress made. I think it's difficult to imagine Bush or Clinton really putting the kind of energy into getting a healthcare bill that people are going to be happy with.
Yeah.
And that's clearly a huge issue.
Do you think it's actually realistically achievable?
Well, the really controversial aspect of that is what's called the public option, which is whether or not the government will be enacting publicly funded insurance for all Americans, which could then be mandated. And obviously this would be the only credible way of ensuring that everybody in the country had affordable health care. However, due to right-wing pressure groups and also conservative Democrats from basically Republican states, people have been saying this looks a little bit like a government takeover of healthcare, and that's really the sticking point.
Do you think he has enough control of the two parts of the American government to really, for the Democrats to be able to push this through?
Well, it's a question of which Democrats are going to be pushing it through. And one of one of the things that he's learned from Clinton, and specifically from what gets called Hillary Care, is that it's important to let the Houses of Congress work out their own bill before the president steps in. He's been very reticent so far about coming down on any kinds of parts of the healthcare legislation. Maybe too reticent. But Clinton was certainly too forward. He just presented Congress with a bill that his wife had written, Hillary Clinton had written. She was hated at the time, and the bill was just easily destroyed. So it makes a certain degree of sense. The problem being that at the moment, the people who are the loudest voices tend to be what are called the Blue Dog Democrats. These are the conservative Democrats who are most violently opposed to a public option. Now, one is hoping that across the recess, particularly since it doesn't look like there'll be anything before recess, Obama will have the opportunity to really make the case in public for a public option, which hasn't really been
happening. Why do a lot of people in America not like the idea of something like our NHS? Because to us, that seems really odd. Not
yeah, well, it is very odd. And I was in North Carolina recently, and I was speaking to a Republican organizer, and she asked me, you know, is it true that in Britain, it's frequently the case that ambulances rock up at hospitals and aren't allowed into the building, so people just die in ambulances because bureaucrats won't let them through the door because of government-set targets? And all I could say was, no, that is not the case at all. That doesn't happen in any situation that I've ever heard about. I think what really scares people is the idea that the state would have something like a monopoly on the provision of healthcare, and people are terrified of bureaucrats. But honestly, the real answer to your question, if one could be candid for a moment, is that the Republican Party and the right-wing activists who make these arguments so viciously and openly in public are all in the pockets of the healthcare lobbying industry and the pharmaceutical industry, and it's transparently a self-serving maneuver to try and provide a logic for really closing a market to a very small and very aggressive cabal.
Guantanamo Bay and the closure of it seems to be taking an exceptionally long time. Is it really going to happen, or is he going to backtrack?
It's going to happen. The question will be what happens to the prisoners, and in some cases that's going to be really difficult and painful, and I know that a lot of us are prepared for disappointment on this. We are hearing a lot of reticence from individual states in America about whether or not they are prepared to take prisoners. We know that Obama's got into problems with the British government over this after he said that, of course, Britain will take back the British prisoners in Guantanamo. And Miliband says, no, we're not really prepared to do that. So there's a lot of wrangling to go on. And certainly it doesn't look like people will just be freed. The thing that will happen is that the illegally occupied, imperially occupied base on Cuban soil will be closed, and prisons will be opened up elsewhere, which will not solve by any means the problem, but will be an improvement in certain kinds
of ways. On the whole, up until now, the first 6 months, what do you think the best things that Obama has really done that you know, nobody else probably would have done?
Well, I think the real high point for me has been the Sotomayor confirmation pending, but she will be confirmed. Here's a situation where Obama is nominated for the Supreme Court. Sonia Sotomayor, an incredibly talented and incredibly committed and articulate and intelligent and qualified Supreme Court justice, who is going to do a very great deal of good on the court. But more than that, what he's done is really made an argument about affirmative action present and all over the American press and all over American discourses, and he's really gone some way to marginalise the voices on the right, like Newt Gingrich, who constantly still peddle the same anti-affirmative action, very white and very conservative discourses, which have been so damaging. So that's been a real high point for me, and I think for many people in America.
Okay, I mean, lastly, on the whole, honestly, do you think, bearing in mind he's going to have an awful lot of problems trying to push through a lot of what he wants, do you think on the whole this first administration of Obama's is going to be mostly good or kind of disappointing? What do you really feel?
Well, it's difficult to see that anything could live up to the hopes that the campaign established. But I think at the moment there is good cause to feel that America will look like a lot better place in 3.5 years' time than it did 6 months ago. And I'm looking forward to watching the country grow and develop in that way.
Joseph Lavery, thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk. Your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Over to Tony Gosling now for this week's feature. It's part four of four, a four-part series about 21st century espionage. The theme is the practice by Israeli firms who create telecoms software by creating sort of digital backdoors in the software so that intelligence communities can access the telecommunication software and use it to spy on people.
On a long-standing government espionage investigation, federal officials this year have arrested or detained nearly 200 Israeli citizens suspected of belonging to a, quote, organized intelligence gathering operation. The Bush administration has deported most of those arrested after September 11th, although some are in custody under the new anti-terrorism law. Cameron also described an investigation into the possibility that an Israeli firm generated billing data that could be used for intelligence purposes and described concerns that the federal government's own wiretapping system may be vulnerable. Tonight, in part four of the series, we'll learn about the improbable roots of the probe, a drug case that went bad 4 years ago in L.A.
Los Angeles, 1997. A major local, state, and federal drug investigation sours. The suspects? Israeli organized crime, with operations in New York, Miami, Las Vegas, Canada, Israel, and Egypt. The allegations? Cocaine and ecstasy trafficking, and sophisticated white-collar credit card and computer fraud. The problem? According to classified law enforcement documents obtained by Fox News, the bad guys had the cops' beepers, cell phones, even home phones under surveillance. Some who did get caught admitted to having hundreds of numbers and using them to avoid arrest. Quote, this compromised law enforcement communications between LAPD detectives and other assigned law enforcement officers working various aspects of the case. The organization discovered communications between Organized Crime Intelligence Division detectives, the FBI, and the Secret Service. Shock spread from the DEA to the FBI in Washington and then the CIA. An investigation of the problem, according to law enforcement documents, concluded, quote, the organization has apparent extensive access to database systems to identify pertinent personal and biographical information. When investigators tried to find out where the information might have come from, they looked at Amdocs, a publicly traded firm based in Israel. Amdocs generates billing data for virtually every call in America, and they do credit checks. The company denies any leaks, but investigators still fear that the firm's data is getting into the wrong hands. When investigators checked their own wiretapping system for leaks, they grew concerned about potential vulnerabilities in the computers that intercept, record, and store the wiretapped calls. A main contractor is Comverse Infosys, which works closely with the Israeli government and under a special grant program is reimbursed for up to 50% of its research and development costs by Israel's Ministry of Industry and Trade. Asked this week about another sprawling investigation and the detention of 60 Israelis since September 11th, the Bush administration treated the questions like hot potatoes.
I would just refer you to Department of Justice with it. I'm not familiar with the report.
I'm aware that some Israeli citizens have been detained. With respect to why they are being detained and the other aspects of your question, whether it's because they are in intelligence services or what they were doing, I will defer to the Department of Justice and the FBI to answer that.
Beyond the 60 apprehended or detained and many deported since September 11th, another group of 140 Israeli individuals have been arrested and detained in this year in what government documents describe as, quote, an organized intelligence gathering operation designed to, quote, penetrate government facilities. Most of those individuals said they had served in the Israeli military, which is compulsory there, but they also had, most of them, intelligence expertise and either worked for Amdocs or other companies in Israel that specialize in wiretapping. Earlier this week, the Israeli embassy here in Washington denied any spying against or in the United States. Tony?
Carl, we've heard the comments from Ari Fleischer and Colin Powell. What are officials saying behind the scenes?
Well, there's real pandemonium described at both the FBI, the DEA, and the INS. A lot of these problems have been well known to some investigators, many of whom have contributed to the reporting on this story. And what they say is happening is supervisors and management are now going back and collecting much of the information because there's tremendous pressure from top levels of all of those agencies to find out exactly what's going on. At the DEA and the FBI, already a variety of administrative reviews are underway in addition to the investigation of the phenomenon. They want to find out how it is that all this has come out, as well as be very careful because of the explosive nature and very political ramifications of the story itself. Tony?
All right, Carl, thanks.
you're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
That was Dialect's Tony Gosling's last feature on 21st Century Espionage, but I'm sure there'll be plenty more stuff about espionage coming from him in the coming months, years and decades. For this week's instalment of Innkeeper's Diary, hooray, read by Malcolm Greaves quite excellently. A story set in Oxfordshire in the 1920s, and if you've been listening, if you have eagle ears, out of the need for a living in 1922, Mr. John Fothergill moved with his family to Tame in Oxfordshire to run the Spread Eagle Inn. The people and customs he came across were not quite what he was expecting or used to, so he wrote about his experiences in a diary. The intro music is a tune called Old Molly Oxford and was performed by musicians in the famous Royal Navy Volunteer Pub in Bristol.
An Innkeeper's Diary by John Fothergill. Regrets. Empty house. And only a few passers-by to lunch. Rain, the publican's ruin. And no one to dinner. Nice people have been here in the past, but may never have the chance to return. Nice people who come from inquisitiveness, perhaps, and will never come again. And certain nice people can't come, well, ever again at all. Everyone knows of us, and there never was a greater success d'esteem save Will Rothenstein's undated pictures. Guy Vaughan Morgan brought one massy Canadian and his pretty wife to lunch. Con of Oriel dined with Brooks and two others. Old Dons. Con, though a clever and original little thing, wrote a book called The Fool. As I was turning it over at the bookstall on its day of publication, I found him standing at my elbow, looking already tired. So I bought it. I wish more Dons would come here, but as they get free meals at the college, it's not to be expected. Without doubt, our dinner and its surroundings are the best bargain in England. When Mary Somerville, one of our foundation stones, told some people that ours are the most celebrated hotel in this part of the world, I objected to her limiting the area. But she had in mind Clough Williams Ellis's astonishing invention at Port Merion. I said that hotels like his, the Beetle and Wedge, Philip Sainsbury's, and perhaps others, and mine, had no competitors or comparisons, simply because they are expressions of different individualities, and as such are not for universal appreciation. This inn, 14 crooked miles from a town, has been created in 4 years out of none of those factors that are the making of hotels that otherwise could never have existed for a day. Not golf, nor shooting, hunting, riverside, seaside, climate, landscape, main road, nor jazz or cocktails. I've used only food, wine, furniture, and people with which to express myself in the language of innkeeping. Innkeeping. Mary Dowdle won't grow old. She is a lovely person. Mr. and Mrs. Barrington Ward, Christchurch, came to dinner. She delightfully pretty and boy-like, with a pale face, bright teeth and black silky Eton crop. He, shy. Mr. and Mrs. Orwin and family came for their silver wedding. Golden themselves. Patrick de Laszlo and Derek Jackson, physicists, are of the most urbane, attractive and appreciative dining couples that we have here. Yes, it's courage, chiefly, that one wants here. You get 70 to lunch on Sunday, but this is reduced to a poor average when you get 3 the next day, and so on all the next week, perhaps. The 12-foot Patagonian. When we were at Weston-super-Mare, we discovered for tuppence on the old pier a mummy of a Patagonian 12 feet high, with 2 heads. I told Philip Goose about it, the author of The Pirates Who's Who, etc. Odd and disgruntled to look at, but in reality a cheerful, whimsical and generous creature. And he told me it must be a fake, a very jolly fake, and much to be encouraged and believed in. So I wrote to an important doctor at Weston to ask him kindly to examine it, giving my undertaking to keep it secret, should he have to pronounce it a fake. I enclosed a letter from the distinguished bacteriologist Dr. John Freeman, assuring him of my bona fides. The important doctor replied that his time was not his own, and that he had never heard of a man of that height, therefore it must be a fake. He would like one day to see it, but he was, he feared, a confirmed sceptic. and required some ingenuity to thank this busy man for his trouble. So I appointed a commission of inquiry consisting of Guy Brown, physicist, the radiologist at Weston-super-Mare Hospital, and a local doctor, who kindly inspected it thoroughly and found no perceptible evidence of its being a fake. Commander Gould, in his fascinating oddities, has exploded to his own satisfaction the Patagonian giant myth, but he did not know of this one. Trippers go and see it for tuppence. They are sure they are being taken in, and for tuppence they don't mind, but they don't talk about it when they go home, hence the poor thing's obscurity. I told young medical Rhinelander that this huge fellow might be, after all, no corroboration of the giant myth, being probably only a potential 6-foot twins, like the Ward twins of 6'4" each, boiled into one, their heads only claiming separate identity. But Rhinelander held that the man must plainly have been from one egg, with an extra head, just as some people are born with 6 fingers, and lambs with extra heads. At least 2 women have asked me if he lived long. I hear it's now in the local museum. I told David Garnett about it, and the elements of a tragedy that Kate had invented. He said he would make a story of it. Today, at lunch, months afterwards, he had done nothing about it, so he started at once to dictate his story before the fire to his companion. Some time later I asked him to write for my The Fothergill Omnibus, and I had no answer. A year afterwards, he crept into lunch saying that he dared not say he would do it, because he was so afraid that he wouldn't, and yet wouldn't say he couldn't, because he would like so much to. So he couldn't reply, which ugly complex, I imagine, had also kept him away all this time. He's so lazy and lovable. A curious solicitor, Canon Brooks, brought a young Australian, Alfred O'Shea, to lunch, who afterwards asked if we had a piano and if he might sing. So I sent them over to the market room, where there is an old piano, which, for lack of space, we keep out of doors during the summer. Later I heard peals of wonderful singing, so I rushed round for an audience. I could find only 2 little scullery maids and a dear temporary cook weighing 19 stone. And in this shape we stood in a row behind him, much to his delight when he turned round. What will happen to this young man? Will he get eaten up by a rich woman? Or continue to sing to any person and any piano?
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
Thank you, Malcolm, and you can hear another instalment next week. Our next feature is by Anthony Page. It's from the recent Trowbridge Village Pump Festival in Farley Hungerford in Wiltshire.
Hi, my name's Brian May. I'm one of the organisers here at Trowbridge Village Pump Festival. My duties on-site are as duty manager, and in advance I do a lot of the ticket selling.
And have you been involved in it since its inauguration?
Not since its inauguration, because you have to realise that this is now 36 years in the running. But I've been involved since 1981.
Can you tell us how it started?
It started in the one of the outbuildings at the back of the Lamb Pub in Trowbridge, down by the big roundabout near Newtown.
So it started as a little folk festival originally?
Very, very much a little folk festival. The Village Pump Folk Club ran in an outbuilding at the Lamb, and it was decided that one year, hey, why don't we have a festival? And some events were put on in the town hall. The campsite was across town. There was a marquee erected at the back of the pub, and we had 2 venues in the yard of the pub. The only electricity I seem to remember was a 13-amp socket.
So how many people came to the first one?
Overall, it was about 200 at the first one.
Yeah. And how many people come now?
Oh, we're now talking that, you know, that our licence is up to 8,000, but we generally aim to get about 5,000 people in.
Do you think it's got too big then?
No, that's what a lot of people say. We like Trowbridge Festival because it hasn't got too big. We can safely accommodate that amount of people on site and still have it comfortable for the punters who come to enjoy it. Bigger bands, no. We go for good all-round quality bands, some good headliners who are established, people know who they are. We're not suddenly going to jump onto some new bandwagon because, you know, thousands of people want this band, because we want bands which are going to just fill our area. I would say that it's really taken off within the last 10 years. People come back year and year again. You know, it's, you meet an old friend from one year to the next.
Have you been affected by the credit crunch at all?
I think everybody's been affected by the credit crunch. We've certainly had to tighten our belt in you know, trying to make, you know, cost savings in you know, certain areas, but we haven't cut down on, you know, the toilet facilities. In fact, we've improved the toilet facilities for the customers.
And what about the storeholders? Are they finding it more difficult?
The vast majority of our traders seem to be doing okay. Sunny weather always helps. People like to go out, wander around, eat al fresco. You get the rain, everybody suffers.
What's the biggest name this year?
We aim for a real big name every night. Friday was the Alabama Three. Last night we had the Saw Doctors and Loudon Wainwright. And tonight, lots of people come to see Baba Mal.
My name's Paul. I'm a spa jester and I make puppets. I also live in Totnes. Come here for the festival.
Can you describe what you're doing at the moment?
Well, with a few of my friends here, we're using recycling materials to turn them into giant puppets. And we're wandering the festival site as the ghosts of kings and queens.
And what's your character?
Mine is the ghost of a king of Australia. Petembe, he was called.
Was there a king of Australia?
There was, yes, but he was a black king and he was there a long time before the whites came.
So what do you do with your puppet at the festival?
Yeah, talk to people. Lots of children are particularly interested. Some love it and some are very frightened of it.
Do you have a puppet theatre in Totnes?
Spa Jesters, we're called.
Does this go back to folk history?
I'd say it was more hippie, really. It was much more hippie than folk.
My name's Patricia. And my puppet is the Queen. She's very royal, but can be very, very lazy. She doesn't like to walk, and she never carries money. She has people to do that for her.
And where did you get the idea from?
Well, actually, the idea was from my friend here. She needed somebody else who is a dancer. We're both dancers, traditional dancers. We're Morris dancers. And we know a lot of the steps, folk steps. And I am also a beauty and makeup artist, because when you go out in the evening, a good makeup is very important.
My name's Saz, and yeah, the reason that they've got orange and fluffy material on is years ago I made some puppets all out of fluff, and over the years, as I've changed the puppets, and each year I make different ones, I rip them apart because I think I don't like them anymore, and then make other ones out of all the bits and pieces. So the fluff sort of shrunk over the years and other bits have been added. And so they just sort of evolve each year and change each year. And sometimes I keep them for a couple of years and then I get bored with them and change them.
Where did you get your inspiration from?
I just get like an idea and I jot it down in a tiny little drawing about 2 inches big. And then I just make them from that. They just sort of come to me. You know, and this year I had the idea that if I added the crowns, I could add the height without needing a huge vehicle to get them all here.
Yeah, how tall are they?
I think Paul's is probably, that's got to be about 14 foot with the crown on. And mine and Patricia's must be sort of 10 foot, I'm thinking, with the crowns on.
And are you unique? Are you the only ones that appear at festivals?
No, there's lots of people that do giants, and I always think other people's giants are more beautiful than mine. What I hope is that it would make people look at them and think, oh, wow, we can make those with our kids at school, and because they are so simple.
What do you do at festivals, though, with them? Do you talk to people? Do you have a script?
Yeah,
do you do a play?
No, we just walk around and chat to people, play with children if they want to be played. Lots of people like their photographs taken. of course, you know, what I like to do best is to get in and dance, because obviously I love to dance.
Swimming club, when days are hot, when days are cold, in the swimming club. Side stroke, breaststroke, fancy diving too. Don't you think it really is the loveliest thing to do?
Oh, hello, I'm Sophie.
And I'm Rowan.
And you've got swimsuits on. Tell us what you're going to do.
We're doing a procession to the swimming place at the river. So part of the Fringe Festival.
At Traybridge Village Pump.
Yes.
Thank you for that.
And there's about 15 of us. We've all got beautifully homemade costumes on, and we're going to process down to the river and go for a swim.
Do you do this every day at the festival?
We do it every day, generally. Yeah, but this is a one-off. One-off with the costumes.
Yeah, normally we don't wear costumes.
Well, you just go naked down the street.
Yeah, just naked.
There are quite a lot of people here today, though.
Why are you wearing a life belt? Is it deep in there?
I'm wearing this life belt because I'm not a very strong swimmer. And we're very health and safety conscious here at Farley Hungford. We don't want anyone to go in the river and go out of their depth or to drown or...
Well, we're not encouraging people to go in the river, but obviously we will be getting in ourselves.
Okay. So let's have a look at this costume.
It's a delightful turquoise number with a little bit of black and white
fabric,
fake fur attached.
That's not fake, Sophie.
It's not fake. It's from a real zebra.
It's very expensive, this one.
And it's got a lovely netting tail at the back. It's fabulous.
We're hoping to start the bids at £700.
We might find a taker as we wander through the festival site.
And are those real steel safety pins on there?
They're silver, yeah.
Silver, real silver. What about your headgear? Is that period? You've got a very funny swim hat.
I have to say, it's actually a genuine 1970s swimming hat.
It looks a genuine. Yeah. It's very unflattering, if I may say.
Thank you.
The goggles look good. Anything else going on in Trowbridge?
Yeah, lots of nice things going on at the Fringe Festival. There's an open mic tonight, and then there's music this evening. And tomorrow we're open. We've got a cafe of delightful cakes.
Oh,
a theatre performance.
9:30
in the evening. There's a performance by Fair Game Theatre Group, and it's based in heaven. So you have to come. Enter the pearly gates and all will be revealed.
And will I get a free halo?
You might well walk away with a free halo.
Thank you.
Or at least some devil's horns.
What were you doing in the car?
We were here to experience this
in-car
little play.
What is it? Can you describe it?
It was called Robomance, and it was about two little robots meeting.
In a car
and travelling down a tunnel of love, what do you call it?
A sort of puppet romance involving two little wind-up robots.
Is that the first time you've seen this performance in a car?
I've never seen drama in a car before.
Did you enjoy it?
Yeah, it's good.
Barney Hayward.
Can you tell me what you're doing here today?
Well, we're doing performances in cars, which last between 5 and 10 minutes. And some of them involve film, some of them involve puppetry, some of them have actors. So there's just a sort of variation of different things. And they're for 2 to 3 audience members, and they get to experience something different, hopefully.
What sort of reception have you had from people?
Very good. Lots of people, yeah.
Where did you get the idea from, doing theatre in a car?
Yeah, well, it's just an interesting venue rather than a theatre.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
And thank you to Anthea. She went to the recent Trowbridge Village Pump Festival at Farley Hungford in Wiltshire. Over to Jeff Sparks now for what's going on in Bristol. You look very smart. You look like you're going on a date.
No, I'm not. Just decided for our change. Okay, good evening. This is your What's On guide from Dialect Radio. Starting with Tuesday, 4th of August, and the Canadian psychobilly group The Brains will be performing at the Beer Keller in Bristol with support from the Cheetah Slicks, and also The Pain. Doors open at 7:30 p.m. and tickets are £6 in advance and £7.50 on the door. Moving on to Wednesday, 5th of August, and Voodoo Glow Skulls will be performing at the Beer Keller in Bristol with support from Random Hand and also the Bolsheviks. Doors open at 7:30 p.m. and tickets are £9 in advance. On Thursday, 6th of August, Half Man, Half Biscuit will be performing at Comedia in Bath. Doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are £15 in advance. On to a song of the week, and I feature Blonde on Blonde. This group formed in 1967 in Newport, South Wales, and disbanded in 1972. In their career, they released three albums, and this track, Spinning Wheel, came from the album Contrasts, which was originally released in 1969. That was Blonde on Blonde with Spinning Wheel from the album Contrasts. On Friday 7th of August, and Chris Mayfield will be performing at the Old Duke in Bristol. The gig starts at 9 p.m. and entry is free. On to Saturday 8th of August, and it's the Corrie Fest at the Coronation Tap in Bristol. The event starts at 12 noon and entry is free, and features performances by acts such as James Morton, Phil King and John Fenlon. On Sunday 9th of August, it's day 2 of the Corrie Fest at the Coronation Tap in Bristol. And again, entertainment starts at 12 noon and entry is free. Performances are by acts such as Phil King, The Blues Circus and Saffron Monkey. That is all from me. Thanks for listening. Have a great week. Take care and goodbye.
Phil King sounds like something dodgy you do in an alleyway. If you listen to this on Saturday, then don't forget, of course, the Harbour Festival is on, and it's still on tomorrow, so as long as it's not slinging it down with rain, you can all go down and there'll be stuff going on in Queen Square and around, and look forward to it. Excellent. To finish off the show, we have a song from Ollie the Octopus. It was recorded at last week's Secret Garden Party at Huntingdon. It's called I Believe They're Going to Get You.
Driving at your own risk, they're going to get you, they're going to get you. They can use their Jedi mind tricks, psychometric, biometrics, they're going to get you, they're going to get you. CCTV in your clamshell, turning in the grave of Orwell, they're going to get you, they're going to get you. DNA no longer your
wrong because they mapped out your genome. Be careful what you say when you're on the phone, because they know where you live when you're on your own. Daddy's watch your daughters, there's Prozac in the water, they're going to get you.
Next time, that was good.
Because you think we are paranoid, their forces are still deployed. They get your details in the docu, now they know you, they're going to get you.
Full marks for enthusiasm, it doesn't actually appear there in the song, but you know, that's good.
Be careful what you say.
Was Ollie the Octopus, recorded at last weekend's Secret Garden Party at Huntingdon. That's all from Dialect Radio this week. Thank you very much to our studio guests, Conservative MEP Ashley Fox and Joseph Lavery. They provided very interesting interviews. Thank you to Tony Gosling for his feature on 21st century espionage. Andy Page reported on the recent Trowbridge Village Pump Festival. And next week she's going to be up in Edinburgh for the Edinburgh Fringe, so I'm sure we'll hear about that in a couple of weeks. Malcolm Grieve read excellently another chapter of The Innkeeper's Diary by John Fothergill. And thank you to Jeff Sparks for telling us what's going on. Studio engineer was Mark Condon. And don't forget the Amnesty Fair at Goldeney House this Sunday, the 2nd of August. The producer was Anthony Page, and let's hope that it cheers up a little bit weather-wise and we'll get a bit of a summer at least. One short heatwave doesn't really feel like enough to make a summer, does it? Goodbye and take care of yourselves. I've been John Peters Coleman.